Hello, this is Paula Kaufman with the Herald and Review for Thursday, July 12, 2018. We'll start with an article on the front page headlined, Economy, Impact of the Tariffs, Widening U.S.-China Trade War Has Thousands of Products in Crosshairs, by Joe McDonald, Associated Press, Beijing. China's government vowed Wednesday to take firm and forceful measures as the U.S. threatened to expand tariffs to thousands of Chinese imports, like fish sticks, apples, and French doors, the latest salvo in an escalating trade dispute that threatens to chill global economic growth. China gave no details, but it has plenty of options to retaliate that could extend beyond additional tariffs on U.S. imports. There are fears that Beijing could attempt to disrupt operations of American automakers, retailers, and others that see China as a key market. The spiraling conflict stems from Washington's complaint that Beijing steals or pressures companies to hand over technology, and concerns that plans for state-led development of Chinese champions in robots and other fields might erode American industrial leadership. A possible second round of tariff hikes announced Tuesday by the U.S. Trade Representative targets a $200 billion list of Chinese goods. That came 4 days after Washington added 25% duties on $34 billion worth of Chinese goods, and Beijing responded by increasing taxes on the same amount of American imports. The abrupt escalation is totally unacceptable, said a Commerce Ministry statement. It said Beijing would take unspecified necessary countermeasures to protect its core interests. Asked what Beijing would do, Foreign Ministry spokeswoman Hua Chunying gave no details but said, "We will take firm and forceful measures." Meanwhile, lawmakers went on record Wednesday to express their frustration with the Trump administration's growing use of tariffs as the Senate passed a non-binding resolution designed to give Congress more say about trade penalties imposed in the name of national security. The measure, which passed 88-11, directs Capitol Hill negotiators trying to reconcile separate spending bills to include language giving Congress a role when such tariffs are put in place. Those negotiators are free to ignore the Senate's guidance, and the role that Congress would play would have to be worked out down the road. Senator Bob Corker, Republican of Tennessee, who pushed the tariff language, acknowledged the effort is a baby step. On the House side, a subcommittee scheduled a hearing next week on the impact tariffs are having on U.S. agriculture and rural communities. In a letter to Representative Kevin Brady, chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee, Democrats urged him to bring in administration officials for a trade-related hearing, because Americans need answers about whether the president's policy is working. The Democrats said the global economy is on edge, and we cannot pretend that this is business as usual. The 11 senators who voted against the measures were Republicans from states where Trump has high approval ratings. Senator David Perdue, Republican of Georgia, called on lawmakers to give the president space to negotiate better trade deals. The president is taking a different approach, sometimes controversial, but I believe he's a pragmatist. I believe he wants only one thing for America, and that's results and a level playing field with the rest of the world, Perdue said. We need to give him space to succeed for the American worker and for our American companies here at home. Still, the resolution's lack of teeth prompted even Senator Sherrod Brown, Democrat of Ohio, to support it. Brown has been one of the most vocal supporters of Trump's tariffs on steel and aluminum imports. He said he would do everything in his power to defeat any efforts to rescind them, but said he agreed that Congress should have a role when the tariffs are determined. The USTR, the federal agency that oversees international trade policy and negotiations, said it was responding to Beijing's decision to retaliate instead of changing its policies. Trump has threatened higher tariffs on more than $500 billion worth of goods, or nearly all of China's annual exports to the United States. The USTR will accept public comments on the latest round of tariffs and hold hearings August 20th through 23rd before reaching a decision after August 31st, according to a senior U.S. official who briefed reporters on condition of anonymity. The first U.S. tariff list focused on Chinese industrial products, an attempt to reduce the direct impact on American consumers. The new list includes vacuum cleaners, furniture, auto and bicycle parts, French doors, and plywood. It left untouched U.S.-branded smartphones and laptop computers. That will hit the Chinese export sector hard, said Rajiv Biswas of IHS Market in a report. China imports far less from the U.S. than the U.S. imports from China. That means China's imports of U.S. goods are so small that Beijing cannot match fresh U.S. tariffs, said Vishnu Varathan of Mizuho Bank in a report. China bought $130 billion of U.S. goods last year. Both governments have raised tariffs on $34 billion worth of each other's goods, and already said they are considering additional charges on another $16 billion. That would leave China only $80 billion for further retaliation. Instead, Beijing has other ways to disrupt American companies' operations. Regulators can deny or cancel licenses or launch lengthy tax, environmental, or anti-monopoly investigations. Companies are watching U.S. chipmaker Qualcomm Inc., which has waited months for Chinese regulators to decide whether to allow its proposed $44 billion acquisition of NXP Semiconductors. All other major governments have approved the deal. The economic impact of the conflict already is spreading. The European Union Chamber of Commerce in China said this week its member companies are rearranging the global flow of their goods to make sure any bound for the United States don't pass through China. Envoys from the two sides last met June 3rd, when Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross visited Beijing for talks with Vice Premier Liu He. They have given no indication when they might meet again. Chinese leaders have tried without success to recruit support from Europe and other governments. They criticize Trump's tactics but share U.S. complaints about Beijing's industrial policies. The conflict is far from over, warned Hannah Anderson of J.P. Morgan Asset Management in a report, and the impact will be global. Central Illinois business. Flower farmers to help mansion reopening bloom. Fresh flowers on the table will come from Decatur and beyond, by Donette Beckett, Springfield. Fresh flowers grown in Decatur, Bloomington, Mattoon, and across central Illinois will greet visitors to the governor's mansion on Saturday, when it reopens after $15 million in renovations. Donations from 8 growers in different communities will appear on the dining room table, seating areas, outdoor areas, and catering tables. Several area florists and growers are working together to craft the arrangements and centerpieces for the high-profile celebration, scheduled from 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. Saturday, with a ceremony at 10:30 a.m. The effort grew from a meeting earlier this year of Central Illinois flower farmers who were looking for ways to promote their products. Flower farmers sell their work to florists at farmers markets and for weddings and other special events. Most of us don't have a retail store, said Becky Newton, whose 3-acre flower farm, Wren's Garden, Gate Garden and Studio, is off Baltimore Road in Decatur. Newton contacted the governor's office, asking for opportunities to showcase local products, and the nonprofit Illinois Governor's Mansion Association reached out a few weeks later. The reopening event is the culmination of years of work on the 1855 home, one of the nation's oldest continuously occupied governor's residences. Governor Bruce Rauner and his wife Diana, who moved back into the residence in May, led the private fundraising effort to reverse decades of deferred maintenance. Improvements include increased accessibility, a new roof, and a visitor's center meant to provide an educational experience for visitors. The mansion will also be decorated with more than 80 pieces of Illinois art donated by individuals, organizations, and museums. For the flower farmers, the event offers an opportunity for visitors to see the beauty and availability of their products. "We just want to showcase what we can do as Illinois farmers," said Candace Hart, who owns Pollen and Pastry, a wedding florist and bakery business in Bloomington. While members of the Illinois Flower Farmers Group often talk with each other, this is the first time they've collaborated on an event, Hart said. "It gives people a chance to know about flower farms," said David Annis of Nature Specialties in Mattoon, who also donated to the effort. Annis and others hope to encourage more people to consider locally grown flowers rather than those that might be shipped from a distance or even other countries. In addition to supporting local businesses, he said, they're likely to receive a more vibrant result. "Some flowers don't ship well," he said. "The quality isn't that great when they are shipped in." Members of the Flower Farm Organization say they have noticed growth in their field over the past 20 years. Opportunities such as Governor's Mansion event allow a bigger audience to see what they have to offer. "We want people to recognize what we can grow," Hart said. Governor's Mansion Floral Contributors. The following people donated product for the Governor's Mansion reopening: David Annis, Nature Specialties, Mattoon; Stacy Shanks, Locust Creek Flower Farm, Pena; Karen Cherry, Tower Hill; Lindsay and Jared Storm, Bushel and Peck, Decatur; Lisa Cox, Palmyra; Becky Newton, Wren's Gate Garden and Studio, Decatur; Candace Hart, Pollen and Pastry, Bloomington; Vio Veenstra, Harvest and Bloom, Rochester. Those helping design the arrangements were Karen Cherry, Candace Hart, Becky Newton, Vio Veenstra, Lori Laswell Barrett, The Secret Garden, Decatur, and Hannah Malone, True Colors Floral, Springfield. If you go, Illinois Governor's Mansion Renovation Open House, 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. Saturday, July 14th. Illinois Governor's Mansion, 410 East Jackson Street, Springfield. Tickets are available at the gate on the day of the event. On the web, illinoismansion.org. Plane lands on I-55 near Lincoln. No injuries reported as aircraft hits car on emergency descent, by Kevin Barlow, Lincoln. No serious injuries were reported after a small aircraft made an emergency landing and struck at least one vehicle Wednesday afternoon on Interstate 55 near Lincoln. "We were traveling northbound on Interstate 55 after leaving Lincoln and saw this plane to our left near the cornfields," said Ronald Childs of Atlanta, a witness to the crash. "He was kind of low and then just started getting even lower, and so we thought he might be a crop duster. But then the plane ventured past the edge of a cornfield and onto the interstate," Childs said. "He got really low, right above the cars, and we saw his wheel hit the back of a car, knocking the window out," he said. "We were still driving, but we couldn't see him, but we knew he wasn't in the air anymore." The incident occurred about 2:40 p.m. The plane is a Cessna 182B with four seats and was registered to Kilo Aviation out of Lakin. Childs was traveling with his wife, Grace. They stopped, turned around, and returned to the crash scene. There, they saw the small yellow and black single-engine plane resting in the median with its wings still intact. "He was out of the plane and he was fine," said Childs, referring to the pilot. "The driver of the car had his son with him, and they were both fine. But it was pretty intense." Police said William Farnsley, 51, of Austin, Indiana, was attempting to land at Logan County Airport when, for unknown reasons, the plane lost power and was forced to make the emergency landing in the southbound lanes of the interstate. During the landing, the plane struck a passenger vehicle, causing minor damage to the automobile, driven by a 42-year-old O'Fallon man who was traveling with his 9-year-old son, police said. The pilot tried to land the plane in the southbound lane, but it traveled through the median and came to rest on the left shoulder of the northbound lanes, police said. The plane suffered damage to the landing gear and was towed from the scene, police said. "It was an amazing thing to see," said Bill Thomas of Lincoln, who was also traveling north at the time of the crash. "It was surreal. It really took a minute to sink in, to realize you were witnessing something out of the ordinary." All lanes were reopened by 5:20 p.m. Police said the investigation into the crash was continuing. State's most heartbreaking moments ranked: the State Journal Register, a president's death, the Great Chicago Fire, and the deadliest tornado in American history topped the list of Illinois' most heartbreaking moments as chosen by voters participating in the Illinois Top 200 project. Illinoisans have celebrated countless triumphs over the past 200 years, as well as many tragedies, natural disasters, horrifying accidents, even outbursts of violence. Often, these heartbreaks were met by people banding together to help one another or take steps to prevent future misfortunes. Here's the list of heartbreaking moments as selected by online voters. Lincoln assassinated. Yes, it took place in Washington and was a national tragedy, but the 1865 murder of Abraham Lincoln hit especially hard in his home state. Some 75,000 people visited the old state capitol to see Lincoln's body during the 24 hours it lay in state in Springfield. Chicago Fire. On October 8, 1871, fire broke out in a barn southwest of Chicago's Loop. It spread rapidly, killing about 300 people and leaving one-third of the city's population homeless. The city soon adopted better fire codes, rebuilt, and entered a period of tremendous growth. Tri-State Tornado. The deadliest tornado in U.S. history hit southeast Missouri, southern Illinois, and southern Indiana on March 18, 1925. At least 695 people were killed, more than 600 of them in Illinois. Murfreesboro suffered 234 deaths, and two Illinois towns were essentially wiped off the map. 1993 flood. The Mississippi and Missouri rivers rose to unprecedented levels in the spring of 1993 and stayed there for months. Flooding lasted 195 days at Grafton and 152 days at Quincy. Afterward, the entire town of Valmire was rebuilt on higher ground. Death in the mines. Illinois suffered three of the worst mining disasters in U.S. history. The deadliest occurred in Cherry in 1909, when a fire killed 259 men and boys. In 1947, an explosion killed 111 people near Centralia. 4 years later, a West Frankfort mine was rocked by an explosion that killed 119 miners. Chicago riots. Martin Luther King Jr.'s assassination shocked America and triggered multiple riots. Chicago saw some of the worst violence. More than 48 hours of rioting left 11 people dead, 48 wounded by police gunfire, and 90 police officers injured. Eastland disaster. On July 24, 1915, people crowded aboard the excursion boat SS Eastland, docked in the Chicago River. The unstable ship rolled onto her side, throwing people against bulkheads, piling them atop one another, and trapping them underwater. The disaster killed 844 people. Effingham Hospital fire. Flames engulfed the 100-bed St. Anthony's Hospital on April 4, 1949. A total of 74 people died, including 11 infants and the nuns who stayed with them. Investigators found many safety deficiencies in the hospital, which inspired new regulations to prevent similar tragedies. Decade of racial violence. In 1908, white mobs attacked Springfield's black residents, burning their homes, beating them, and killing some. The scene repeated itself on a larger scale 9 years later in East St. Louis, and then again in Chicago in 1919. The Springfield riot helped spur creation of the NAACP. Tylenol murders. Tylenol capsules laced with cyanide killed 7 people in the Chicago area in 1982, prompting new safety measures for over-the-counter medicines. The killer was never found. The Illinois Top 200 Project lets Illinoisans vote every 2 weeks on the most inspiring leaders, greatest inventions, top businesses, and much more. By the state's 200th birthday on December 3rd, voters will have chosen 10 items in 20 different categories, the Illinois Top 200. Voting in the next category, Top Musicians, is underway at www.illinoistop200.com. The nominees include Muddy Waters, Alison Krauss, Nat King Cole, Smashing Pumpkins, and Sir George Schulte. The Illinois Top 200 is a joint initiative of the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum, the State Journal Register, and the Illinois Bicentennial Commission. Future categories include actors, leaders, and unforgettable moments. Everyone is invited to suggest possible nominees in each category by using the hashtag ILTOP200 on social media. Police. Witness saw driver hide gun, drugs, by Tony Reed. Decatur. Sharp-eyed witnesses told police where to look to find a hidden stash of illegal drugs and a stolen handgun after a driver crashed his car on Decatur's western edge, police said. The crash had happened June 4th at the intersection of Illinois 121 and the Interstate 72 interchange, according to a sworn affidavit from Decatur police that was released Wednesday. The 19-year-old driver was not arrested until Tuesday, however, and the affidavit did not explain the delay. The affidavit said witnesses told police they had seen the driver, his disabled vehicle stuck on the median, climb out and hide a black box amid the underbrush in a nearby ditch. He then went back to his car and waited for the police to arrive. The affidavit said police asked the driver about what he had hidden, and he denied disposing of anything in the ditch. A Decatur police officer then went to the area the witnesses had pointed out and immediately retrieved a black metal briefcase. The affidavit said a canine unit was brought in from the Warrensburg Police Department, and the dog immediately indicated on the briefcase. Inside, the affidavit said, police found a 9mm handgun that checked as stolen. Police also found 5.6 grams of methamphetamine concealed in a secret compartment inside a coffee mug, which also held a measuring cup and 8 plastic baggies, the affidavit said. The affidavit said 13 grams of cannabis was found in a separate container in the briefcase, along with a digital scale marked by drug residue. The affidavit, which described Detective Lauren Sturdivant as the arresting officer, said the drugs, scale, and baggies are consistent with items carried by a drug dealer. And I know from training and experience that some drug dealers will possess handguns for protection while they are out delivering drugs, the affidavit added. The driver was booked on preliminary charges of armed violence, possession of a weapon by a felon, possession of a stolen firearm, and possession of meth and cannabis with intent to deliver. Preliminary charges are subject to review by the Macon County State's Attorney's Office. The driver remained in the Macon County Jail on Wednesday night in lieu of posting $75,000 bond. Briefs, Herald and Review and Associated Press. Scam targets Decatur Memorial patients. Decatur. Some patients and caregivers were targeted by a phone scam pretending to be Decatur Memorial Hospital, according to a statement from the hospital. DMH has been made aware of potential phone scam activity, making use of its caller ID, DMH spokeswoman Ann Davis said. The phone number shows up as DMH, but Davis said it is not the hospital. The caller asks the recipient for a bank account number and other personal information. No one should give out personal information without verifying its purpose with the DMH main hospital line. Anyone who receives a call should hang up, Davis said. If a patient is concerned that the call is real, they are encouraged to call DMH at 217-876-8121. If the scammer leaves a message, David said people should not call that number back, but should instead call the hospital. People can also report the scam call to their local police department. SIU president receives no confidence vote. Carbondale. Southern Illinois University's president has received a vote of no confidence from the Faculty Senate at the school's Carbondale campus. The Southern Illinoisan in Carbondale reports the resolution that passed 25-1 on Tuesday accuses Randy Dunn of working to undermine the SIU system and urges the Board of Trustees to remove him as soon as possible. The Faculty Senate vote comes in the wake of failed efforts by members of the Board of Trustees in June to place Dunn on administrative leave. Dunn has been criticized over his handling of a proposal to shift $5.1 million in state funding from the Carbondale campus to the Edwardsville campus. The Board of Trustees split 4-4 to place Dunn on leave after an email surfaced in which he used a slur to refer to critics of the reallocation. Police investigate car vandalism, Decatur. Police are investigating after vehicles parked on a Decatur street were defaced with spray paint late Monday or early Tuesday morning. Detective Sergeant Steve Carroll with Decatur Police said at least three vehicles were targeted in the 1,000 and 1,200 blocks of North Edwards Street between 9 p.m. Monday and 6 a.m. Tuesday. Carroll said police want to hear from witnesses or anyone with information. Call 217-424-2711 or Crime Stoppers at 217-423-8477. Tips. Man shot by police mad at government. South Elgin. Relatives say a suburban Chicago man who was killed by police at officers because he was distraught over financial woes and other problems. Frank Dibbs was fatally shot on July 4th, the climax of an overnight standoff in South Elgin. Police say three officers were shot by Dibbs, but their injuries weren't serious. Dibbs' sister, Deborah Martin, tells the Courier News that it pains the family to know officers were injured. Paula Dibbs said her husband had just learned that his Social Security disability benefits were being eliminated. The government also was demanding repayment of $6,000 to $7,000. Paula Dibbs says he was mad at the government. Police responded to shots fired at the couple's condo. Deborah Martin says her brother wanted to end his life. Dropped gun leads to charges. Megan Krepow and Jeremy Gorner, Chicago Tribune. A veteran Cook County judge was hit with a misdemeanor gun charge after a sheriff's deputies saw him drop a pistol last week in the lobby of the county's main criminal courthouse, authorities said. Judge Joseph Claps, who has presided over felony criminal cases at the Layton Criminal Court Building, was reassigned last week to nonjudicial duties, pending a meeting Wednesday of the Circuit Court's Executive Committee, a spokesman for Chief Judge Timothy Evans' office said. Claps was walking in the lobby of the courthouse at 26th Street and California Avenue on July 3rd when two deputies noticed a handgun fall out of a pocket draped over the judge's arm, according to a sheriff's incident report. Security cameras captured the gun tumbling out of Claps' jacket, as well as the judge picking up the silver pistol and putting it in his pants pocket, the report said. The gun is believed to have been loaded, said Kara Smith, Chief Policy Officer for Sheriff Tom Dart. We'll take a short break now and return with the second half hour of the Herald and Review for Thursday, July 12th. Please stay tuned.